Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, August 5th, 2025, and our friend Professor Mirandi is back with us. Welcome back, Professor.
Hi, Nima. Thank you for inviting me.
Let me start with the latest escalation between the United States and Russia. The United States is trying to somehow convince Iran not to go after nuclear weapons, or trying to say that it's good for us, but it's not good for the others. But how about the latest escalation? What does that mean for Iran when the United States, in response to what was somehow some sort of escalation on the part of Russians, but they were talking about the conventional weapons. They didn't talk about nuclear weapons. The United States is threatening Russia by sending two submarines, nuclear submarines, close to Russia. And this is some sort of escalation that we haven't seen before, even during the Biden administration. And the United States, on the other hand, has decided to put the missiles, nuclear missiles, back in Europe. They have withdrawn them in 1980s, and the Trump administration has decided to put them back. They can be used by F-35 against Russia. What does that mean for Iran, in your opinion?
Well, first, I think we have to keep in mind that the United States brought nuclear weapons to the UK before the Medvedev tweet. And so I think that's the real escalation, when you bring nuclear weapons closer to Russian borders. That is the highest form of escalation without actually using nuclear weapons. So the fault lies with the United States and with Trump. The tweet by Medvedev is not really all that important. Maybe it could have been written better, but he's not the president of Russia. He's not the decision maker. And Trump's response was not really very meaningful, because based on my understanding, the nuclear submarines are already in the oceans, as they always are under normal circumstances. And they rotate. But I think the most important thing for me, looking at it from an Iranian perspective, is that in the past, the United States always tried to contain Iran, as they'd like to call it, or tried to harm Iran, or tried to undermine Iran, or tried to break Iran through sanctions and threats. So on the one hand, the Americans would impose brutal sanctions, not just because of Iran's nuclear program, which is peaceful. The Americans are saying Iran shouldn't have the ability to enrich uranium. The issue has never been about nuclear weapons. They're saying Iran should not be able to enrich uranium. It's like telling a country you're not allowed to have produce your own oil. You have to import oil. You can have a refinery, but you'll have to import the oil. So on the one hand, they punish and hurt Iranians, ordinary Iranians, because they want to block Iran from having a nuclear program. But then they also punish Iran for having a defense program. Its missile defense capabilities are also another excuse for the Americans to punish Iranians. And all of this, of course, is about Israel. So, whether it's the nuclear program, or whether it's a missile program, or whether it's human rights or global warming or whatever, they'll always find an excuse to sanction Iran, to hurt Iran, because the Americans and the Israeli regime have one policy for the region, and that is Israeli supremacy. But now the weapons that have been in the past used basically for Iran more than any other country, although you could also include small countries like Cuba or smaller countries. I mean, Cuba is an important country. It's had a very important role in the 20th century in the anti-imperialist movement. But in any case, Iran was the first power that was attacked by the United States through sanctions and also the threats of war. We've heard all options are on the table, being used for president after president after president against Iran. Now what the United States is doing is that it's using the same models, as you alluded to, for Russia, for India, for China, for Brazil, interestingly, for important BRICS nations, and in other countries that it antagonizes. And this provides a lot of breathing room for the Iranians, because they are no longer facing they're not the focus of U.S. antagonism. Now U.S. antagonism is basically being spread across the globe. And it's sort of like when they put butter on bread. The larger the piece of bread, the thinner the butter. And so it's much more difficult for the Americans today to focus on Iran. And also, because all these other countries are being antagonized by the United States, those countries have an incentive to move closer towards Iran and to one another. And I think, for example, what the United States is doing with India is extraordinarily foolish, because the Americans have been courting the Indian government for decades now, and Trump is throwing it out the window. Now there may be a deal, and Trump may back down, but still the way in which he's been treating India, the insulting remarks made by Trump, insulting remarks made by senior U.S. government officials are not lost upon ordinary Indians. It's going to have a lasting impact. So this, I think, is for Iran. It empowers the country, because the United States can no longer. So, for example, just one simple example. In the past, the United States focused on blocking Iran from exporting oil, and to a degree was successful. Although partially the fault was the Iranian government too, under President Rouhani, because he did not seek to expand oil exports through means outside the current financial, the Western-dominated financial order. After Rouhani's term ended and President Raisi came to power, he changed the policy, and he decided to push for Iranian oil exports. They were initially heavily subsidized. Then gradually, when Iranian production reached maximum, the price of Iranian oil went up. And today we see Iran is exporting all of its oil. So, but in any case, it was always much more difficult for Iran to export its oil, because the global oil market is large. Iran's oil production is significant, but it does not change the fate of the global oil market, especially since Iran's has been sanctioned for decades. But when Russia is added, then this becomes much more significant. And then you have Venezuela and so on. And so it becomes much more difficult for the Americans to block Iranian oil exports when multiple countries that are major oil producers are sanctioned. And then since these countries are the very fact that they're independent of the West is why they're sanctioned. Other countries that are threatened by the West, in order to gain greater security, energy security that meaning energy from countries that are independent of the West, they tilt towards countries like Iran, Russia, Venezuela, and so on. And since those countries too are being targeted, they feel that this is necessary. So Iranian oil is exported more easily. It becomes increasingly difficult for the Americans to stop it. And there is a greater demand for Iranian oil for the reason that I explained. So the more the Americans spread this net of sanctions and threats of warfare across the globe, the better it is for countries in the global South that have been facing the brunt of American hostility.
Do you feel that, let's put it this way, we know that the Russian gas and energy that is going to India has been attacked. They were attacking these ships that they're carrying Russian oil and gas, but the alternative would be the North-South corridor. Is that going to complicate the situation? Is that going to how is that going to work? How is that? We know that is the Russian the decision on the part of Russians and Iranian is getting somewhere in terms of dealing with these sort of threats, because it's not just about Russia. I'm talking about I mentioned Russia because it shows how, because people are reading about it right now and they know what has, they have to know this is what has happened to Iran for such a long time, and Iran knows what does that mean for them and for their economy. How could this bring Russia and Iran together?
Well, first I should add something that I forgot to say, and that is that these military threats that the United States has been using against Iran, as I alluded to earlier, options are being on the table. These are also now being directed towards other countries like Russia, in the case of the Trump social media posts about nuclear submarines. And this also increases solidarity among non-Western countries with regards to the United States, because countries increasingly see that this is not about Iran. This is about the United States. This is not the fault of the victim. It is the aggressor, meaning the West, the United States, that is making these threats. The threat is not just directed at one particular state. It's directed at multiple states. It's even directed at nuclear states like Russia, which have more nuclear warheads than does the United States itself. So I think that both the sanctions and the threats that the United States makes strengthens Iran, strengthens all of these countries, and draws them closer to each other against the United States. With regards to India, as I was saying earlier, we have to see where this ends and where this leads. If the United States indeed does impose tariffs on India as they've threatened, and the Indians don't back down, then I think that creates a very strong incentive for the North-South corridor to expand more rapidly. Because even though Indian exports to the United States are not enormous, but I think it signals a fundamental shift in the United States away from India. And so India will obviously be searching for new partners. And in among BRICS nations, and I don't want to stress too much on BRICS. BRICS itself is not a NATO, or it's not a European Union type of organization, but it is a place where world leaders, important world leaders, gather together and search for solutions with regards to global issues and crises. So it is an important organization, but we shouldn't exaggerate what BRICS countries do. But in any case, the weakest link in BRICS has been India, and after India, Brazil. And what the United States has done in this latest round is that it has targeted Brazil and India more than any other country, because Russia has already been sanctioned, China is already antagonized, Iran is, of course, facing maximum pressure sanctions since forever. So this, I think, is important. Even if there is a deal, I think it's going to have some sort of impact on the way in which India conducts a foreign policy. And the same is true with Brazil. Because, as I said, as Trump said, words matter, ironically, coming from Trump, that says a lot, because he says a lot of nonsense. But words do matter. And the way in which the United States has treated India over the past few days in particular has been pretty ugly. So this, I think, strengthens BRICS, but I really don't comprehend why Trump is doing this, because if I was among the political elite in the United States, I would definitely not try to push India and Brazil towards other BRICS nations.
I think what's happening to Brazil and India particularly is that whenever the Iranian leadership was talking about the United States is trying to interfere in the domestic policy of Iran. They're trying to do regime change, so-called regime change, color revolution, all of this. We are witnessing right now here in Brazil, the United States is trying to interfere into the domestic policy of Brazil. They're trying to fight against the current president of Brazil. It is something important, because you feel, when you live in Brazil, you feel how the people feel about these sort of pressures coming from the United States on Brazilian economy. It's not on the Brazilian government, again, as Iran was arguing for such a long time. It's on Brazilian people. That's why they're reacting to that. And the other thing would be Lula recently, yesterday, the day before yesterday, he said that they tried to stage a coup here in Brazil. You know, it's all the same game. I think that what's happening right now, it's somehow in Brazil, people are understanding what's going on in terms of the relationship between Brazil and the United States. India somehow getting there. China wasn't there before these sort of tariffs on China. They're getting there. It's somehow the Trump administration pushing all these countries together in unbelievably the way that he's pushing all of them together. It's unbelievable.
Yes, I agree completely. And to a degree, I understand why Trump does this to Brazil, because his ally has just been sentenced to confinement at home. But still, it doesn't make sense. I mean, if I was among the decision makers in the United States, or if I was an advisor, I would say it's not worth it. I wouldn't push Brazil towards U.S. adversaries because of my ally being confined to his home. But in the case of India, it makes even less sense, because the current Indian Prime Minister Modi, he has been trying very hard to have a close relationship with the United States. And the Indian government and its allies have always seen Trump as their natural partner in the United States. So it's very foolish, and it's welcome here in Tehran, I'm sure. It's excellent news. Every escalation between United States and the rest of the world is good news for Iran, because it vindicates Iran. People, you know, just a few years ago, when I would, for example, travel to conferences in countries across the global south, I would often be asked by colleagues, you know, why don't you try to strike a deal with the United States? Why don't you try to overcome the hostility? And I always try to explain that Iran does this, but the problem lies on the other side. The trouble lies with Americans, their exceptionalist worldview, their belief that they are the hyperpower, and that we must be obedient to them, that we must forsake our sovereignty and to give up our rights because they demand us to do so. Now, that has changed completely. Across the world, people recognize and understand clearly why Iran resists, just as they now understand clearly why Iran opposes this genocidal apartheid regime. The world has changed. And since these countries are targeted, or multiple countries are being targeted, people across the global south and even in the west, they are seeing the true nature of the United States, the true nature of the West. And it's interesting how, you know, it goes back to what Kissinger once said: to be an enemy of the United States is dangerous, something like that. But to be a friend is deadly. Look at what Trump has done to the EU and what he wants to do to Canada, and how he's treating allies of the United States, whether it's Japan or South Korea. The closer to the United States you are, the more brutal and the more ugly the deals that are imposed upon these countries, the more brutal the United States behaves at the negotiating table with these countries. So it's basically vindicated those countries in the global south, and it's not just Iran. It makes people better recognize, you know, why Venezuela is Venezuela, why Venezuela is targeted, why Cuba is targeted, why Syria was targeted, why Yemen was targeted, and why Libya was destroyed. It becomes clearer for many, because in addition to all this, we do have another phenomenon, and that is that Western media, which used to have a global reach, and it used to be a monopoly on the discourse to a large degree across the globe. In other words, countries would get their news from Western media, and they would translate that into their own language, and their own populations would hear the news from a Western perspective, basically. Now that is also changing. Across the world, countries are more skeptical of the West. They see these policies, but also there's the rise of alternative media, not just in the West, but across the global South. Voices like yourself and your guests and other similar voices in different languages. So now people are able to, ordinary people, not just governments, ordinary people too are seeing things differently than before. So the West has not only antagonized so much of the globe, but they've lost the narrative. Their narrative has been defeated. And this is only gaining pace. Look at, I mean, a good example is Palestine. The Israeli regime initially had the upper hand after October the 7th for a few months, even though activists were pointing out that this genocidal regime has been carrying out genocide since its inception, and that October the 7th is only a small response to the crimes of the regime against the Palestinian people. Still, they had louder voices, the West, and they produced a narrative that was heard across the world. That gradually changed, but over the past few weeks, I think, especially since we are seeing starving kids, we see a very rapid shift in global public opinion, and even many people in the West who were quiet until now or supportive of the Israeli regime, they've suddenly they're beginning to protest. Most of them are not sincere. They've been with the regime for this whole period, or they were cowardly for this whole period. But because they see how rapidly public opinion is shifting, they don't want to be completely discredited. So they're changing their tone. And that, I think, is all of these things are together. The fact that the United States and the West is antagonizing so many different countries, the fact that the United States is behaving aggressively towards allies, the fact that it's making threats, military threats, the fact that it's sanctioning countries and using tariffs as a weapon, and the fact that we have this alternative media or non-Western media on the rise, all of these are working together. And then you have the genocide taking place in Gaza, the declining Western economy, and the West losing on the battlefield in Ukraine. All of these combined, I think now we're beginning to see them work together to bring about a rapid collapse of the Western narrative.
Isn't that amazing that Steve Witkoff is back to the scene and nobody was talking about him? He just somehow disappeared from the scene. They attacked Russia, then they attacked Iran, 12 days of war. And again, Steve Witkoff coming and trying to contact Iranians, trying to contact Russians to talk with them. And who's going to believe Steve Witkoff anymore?
No sane person is going to believe Witkoff. And this is something I've been seeing online about Iran, and that in Iran, there are lots of people, or let's say politicians or leaders, who are willing to appease the United States and cut a deal with Americans, and that they have some sort of optimism that we can strike a deal with the United States. I don't believe that to be the case. And I think some of our friends online are exaggerating the current administration's statements coming from senior figures in the current administration. In Iran, everyone who is into politics and anyone who has any influence, they are skeptical of the United States, deeply skeptical. No one trusts the United States. In the past, I would argue that a significant segment of the Iranian political elite did. And that led to the 2015 nuclear deal. And I think that optimism was misplaced. And I think time proved that to be correct. But now it is almost universal, a universal belief that we can't do a deal with the United States. It's almost impossible. I'm not saying it's completely impossible. It's very difficult to say that it is utterly impossible, but it's almost impossible to do a deal. When Witkoff, not only did he shift his position, initially he was saying that, yes, enrichment is fine as long as it's at 3.67%. Then he suddenly takes a 180-degree turn, or 360 degrees, as the former German foreign minister would say, a 180-degree turn, and said no enrichment. And then after that, we saw that the United States was actually not negotiating in good faith at all, and it was trying to deceive Iran in order to help the Israeli regime carry out a Nazi-like blitzkrieg attack. That and you know, Trump took credit for that, and we saw the ugly tweets or the posts of Trump calling for regime change in Iran, or speaking of regime change, or absolute surrender, or threatening to murder Ayatollah Khamenei. These were the posts that Trump did at that time. So when you take that into account, but more importantly, the U.S. aggression against Iran, the fact that the Europeans supported aggression against Iran. And then after all that, the fact that Iran won the war. I heard someone told me yesterday, or I read somewhere yesterday, that the New York Times had a piece where they said Netanyahu, after leading Israel to a victory over Iran. That's nonsense. It's clear that the Iranians defeated the Israeli regime. And the very fact that the Israelis were seeking a ceasefire, the very fact that the Iranians got extra concessions from the United States, the very fact that people like Steve Bannon admitted that Trump saved the Israeli regime, which was taking a beating during the last few days, all of this is clear evidence that the Israelis lost the war. So the Iranians, not only are they skeptical of the United States, but the Iranians are much more confident today in their capabilities. They see that despite the fact that the United States and the Israeli regime, the collective West and regional regimes, remember, air bases, radar installations in Turkey and Qatar and the Emirates and elsewhere were used, the airspace of Jordan was used, the collective West was helping the Israeli regime try to bring down drones and missiles. All, you know, despite all of this, Iran had the upper hand. Despite the fact that there was an unprovoked, illegal blitzkrieg attack against the Iranians, where the Iranians took a big hit on day one, they still won. That gave the Iranians enormous confidence. When you are confident, that reflects itself, that is reflected at the negotiating table. Today, the Iranians are going to speak from a position of greater strength than in the past. And we already see that the Iranians have changed the terms. The very fact that the International Atomic Energy Agency has been expelled from the country means that the Iranians have a new card to play with. The West, if they want something from Iran, they're going to have to give more than in the past. This nuclear ambiguity strengthens Iran. And I think that makes the whole assault on Iran carried out by the Israeli regime in the United States a major miscalculation. I mean, they lost the war, but also when it comes to the nuclear program, they strengthened Iran's position. The amount of damage that they did to the Iranian nuclear program, who knows how important it was, how significant it was, especially since these installations are deep underground. But the Iranians have technology, and the Iranians now have shut out the International Atomic Energy Agency. And this is definitely not what the United States and the West were expecting. They were hoping for the collapse of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that itself shows how ignorant they are about the reality on the ground in Iran and how ignorant they are about the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic of Iran among the people in Iran and increasingly across the world. Right now, Iran is looked as a heroic country alongside Yemen that are standing up against the Holocaust, whereas everyone else is silent, or as in regional countries with Erdogan and with Mohammed bin Zayed and Sisi and Abdullah and King Mohammed of Morocco and others, that they are continuing to do business as usual with the regime. So they've made multiple miscalculations. They've strengthened Iran at home. They've strengthened Iran at the negotiating table. And they've strengthened Iran's soft power capabilities across the region and across the world.
Yeah, we've learned, Professor Marandi, from one of the Iranian officials, and he's not part of the government, but he's part of the system, that it's Safar Harandi. He said that Israelis made a phone call to Russians before the war started. They asked Russia to stop cooperating with Iran because Iran will not exist much longer. Is that the case? Did they really do that? And what can we learn about it, in your opinion?
Well, I think from the attack on Iran, it's clear that they invested heavily in overthrowing Iran and undermining Iran. They gave it their best shot. And they used all of their capabilities. And that is going to be very important in any potential next round of fighting. Because now the Iranians know how the Israeli regime hacked systems. Now they know how they use elements to, you know, inside the country to carry out attacks. Now the Iranians know what all the technologies that the Israeli regime has been using, their missiles, their drones. They know a lot. Iran knows a lot more about what the Israeli regime has, what their potentials are, and they'll be working on how to deal with it. And I'm sure when it comes to these latest technologies that the Israeli regime has used, the Iranians will be sharing their information with the Chinese and with the Russians, who will be very keen on learning about these technologies. We have to remember that what Netanyahu had at his disposal goes far further than anything that Zelensky has. The Americans and the Europeans provide this genocidal regime with everything, anything that they need. But they definitely would never do that for Ukraine. So with regards to the latest technologies that were used, the Iranians will be sharing information and learning how to deal with it. The Iranians will be improving their own capabilities, but also they'll be creating countermeasures to prevent the Israelis from being able to do this again. So they gave it their best shot. They tried their hardest to overthrow Iran. And it seems they really did believe that this would happen. The Israeli regime in Washington, the White House, they thought that it was finished. Whereas if anyone had asked me or you or almost anyone in Iran, what did they think would happen? They would say that it would only create a greater resistance in Iran. It would create greater unity in Iran. It would make Iranians more determined, but also more hostile towards Israel and the West. And even after the Blitzkrieg attack, and before the Iranians rallied and and struck back during those hours where we still hadn't seen an Iranian response, I did not see a single person who expressed fear about the future of Iran. There were only questions as to why Iran is not responding. And of course, people understood that when the commanders were martyred and when the Israelis were hacking systems and using terrorists and so on, that it had caused delays. But when the Iranians responded, the Iranian, when the armed forces began their response, the Iranians celebrated. It was exactly as we would have envisaged. But that just shows how the West is delusional. They believe their own propaganda, just like they believe for the last 3.5 years that the Russians are going to lose in Ukraine. Remember how they were saying that the Russians are running out of missiles. The Russians are tearing apart washing machines to take out the chips for their missiles and drones. And it was all nonsense. But that's the narrative that they want to believe. So these so-called experts, Russia experts, just like the Iran experts, tell them what they want to hear. And since there is no accountability in the West, in this think tank world and in the media, the same people who've been saying this nonsense for the last few decades on Iran, over the last few years with regards to Russia or China, they're going to continue to talk. They're going to continue to be the so-called experts. And the United States will continue to misread the situation and miscalculate and get things wrong and make things worse for themselves and for their so-called allies. Although I don't think the United States has any allies anymore. They're all just proxies and subservient regimes. The Europeans, it's obvious that they have no clout anymore. And by the way, the Europeans are also becoming unimportant. And this is not linked to your question, but the Europeans have brought this situation upon themselves. They cut off ties with the Russians. Then they refrained from doing a nuclear deal with Iran. They needed Iranian energy 3.5 years ago when things began to go downhill for the Europeans because of the sanctions against the Russians, the sanctions that they themselves imposed, and the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline that was carried out by the Americans. And they refused to acknowledge that it was Americans, and they still do so. But they needed to deal with Iran. They refrained from doing so because Washington didn't want it. So Europe has been going downhill for the last 3.5 years. Imagine if they had done a nuclear deal with Iran, they could have invested in Iranian oil, in Iranian natural gas, and it would have eased their problems today. And now they're doing a deal with the United States where they will have to import very expensive natural gas, and it will be a monopoly. It will only make things even worse for Europe. And when people across the world see how Europe is in no position to negotiate, India is playing hardball, the Chinese are, the Russians are, the Iranians are, the Brazilians are, but Europe isn't. And that makes them look irrelevant. And in future, no one is going to take them seriously.
It's so amazing that they're talking about the snapback sanctions and they're trying to somehow put pressure on Iran while they know what's going on with the economy, for example, in Germany. And as you mentioned, if they buy oil and gas from the United States, that would hugely influence the German economy, the production of the industry of Germany. And how do you feel that the United States has somehow have these Europeans, or it seems to me that the United States has reached to some sort of agreement with the Europeans to follow their policy in Ukraine, and they somehow get in line with the United States considering Iran. Is that happening in your opinion?
Well, I don't know about Iran. I think that the Europeans have already fallen in line when it comes to Iran for a very long time now. I think they are falling in line on all issues. We see how the EU, when they negotiate with the Chinese, they insult the Chinese. And they've destroyed their relationship with Russia. They've destroyed their relationship with Iran. And if they carry out the snapback, which is a part of the nuclear deal, the 2015 nuclear deal, which was a mistake. I think the Iranians now recognize that they made a mistake in accepting the snapback provisions. But if they carry out the snapback, it will not really have huge impact in Iran, because those sanctions that will be revived at the UN sanctions, they're already being imposed by the Americans through their maximum pressure campaign. But what it will do is that it will make Europe even more irrelevant to Iran. because it's not the Iranians that violated the deal, it was the United States. And then the Europeans, in as they behaved in an obedient manner to the United States, they effectively violated the deal, all of the provisions of the nuclear deal, the 2015 deal, whereas the Iranians were abiding by their commitments. Anyone can go and check the statements of the International Atomic Energy Agency at the time when Trump tore up the deal, that Iran was abiding by its commitments, and that even a year later, Iran continued to abide by its commitments. So if the Europeans use the snapback provisions, that basically is telling the Iranians that, look, in future, keep the Europeans out of everything. We don't need them anymore. They're useless. They're not people who you can negotiate with. So it's going to hurt the Europeans far more than it will hurt the Iranians, because as I said, any sanctions that are revived at the UN Security Council, they're already being imposed on Iran through American maximum pressure sanctions. And the UN Security Council is already losing its significance. We see how North Korea, which has been sanctioned, how the Russians are ignoring the UN resolutions on North Korea. And probably the Chinese are doing the same at a perhaps different level. So it hurts the West more than it hurts Iran. What the Europeans have done over the past 3.5 years is that they've destroyed their economy. They have destroyed their political credibility, and they've showed themselves as insignificant militarily. Even now, you know, part of the agreement, part of the reason why the Europeans capitulated is because they wanted to keep the Americans in Europe, and they promised to buy American weapons. The Germans and the French are talking about creating a military industry, but I don't think the Americans will let them do that. Trump will force them to purchase American goods. So in the coming years, you're going to have a Europe, which I think will, all they'll have left is tourism, I suppose. They brought this upon themselves. They created the European Union in order to create greater internal harmony, as the Chinese would put it, but also in order to have a stronger position at any negotiating table, because they would negotiate collectively. Yet when it came to the negotiations with the United States, they capitulated completely.
Isn't that amazing that Donald Trump, every time he's talking about Ukraine, he says that this is Biden's war, it's not mine. But when he came to power, he just literally destroyed the JCPOA, and they said, so how he was somehow capable of just turning up the JCPOA, but he's not able to do anything in Ukraine. Does that make sense to you?
I think we are seeing increasingly Trump as a weak president. And I think a lot of this may have to do with the Epstein case. We're going to see more information gradually come out, and it is going to increase the pressure on Trump. And I think some of Trump's behavior can be interpreted in this context, that the world is turning against the Israeli regime. Yet Trump is becoming more supportive of this genocide. Openly, so he denied that there's a genocide. He's supporting the Israeli regime. Yesterday, we saw that the Israeli regime has decided that they want to take the Gaza Strip. And obviously, Witkoff is in occupied Palestine. So he obviously was informed and was a part of this decision, most probably. So we see that Trump is taking a harder position. And when it comes to Ukraine, he's increasingly becoming more like Biden. So I think part of this is the fact that the issue of Epstein is causing him difficulties. I don't know if he's it's personal blackmail, or it's others around him, or highly influential people who he depends on that are in trouble. But I think this is probably a part of it. But a part of it is also the fact that he's been captured by the neocons. He's a very ignorant person. He knows very little. Apparently, he watches a lot of Fox News. He doesn't comprehend the complexities of what's going on in our region, in Eastern Europe, and across the world. And I think all of this combined is making him look weak. He's changed completely from I mean, remember on day one when he came to power, he had brought about a ceasefire in Gaza, and he was talking about ending the war in Ukraine. And of course, in order to do so, it was assumed that he would try to address Russia's concerns. Swiftly, he tore up the ceasefire himself. Then we saw gradually him become increasingly similar to Biden. So nothing has changed. The United States under Trump today is probably worse than it was under Biden. And he is becoming increasingly, I mean, his posts, whether it's with regards to international issues or issues at home, his posts are looking increasingly strange. And it seems like he's not very normal. I mean, he never was, I think, normal. But I think now it's becoming increasingly clear that something is wrong with Trump.
Exactly. I think everybody can say that, as we saw what is happening with him. But Professor Marandi, we know that we've learned about the formation of the Supreme Defense Council in Iran, which I would assume is one of the outcomes of what has happened between Iran and Israel. So what does that mean? What's the meaning of this council? Is that related to the Security Council? Is it something different? What can we learn about
it? Yes, it will be under the Supreme National Security Council, which we have. And this council will focus on Iran's security needs. And it's a smaller body, so it will be more focused. And by the way, we're going to have a new head of the Supreme National Security Council.
They have the autonomy. They have the autonomy to somehow, right? Some sort. They make decisions on their part.
Yes, Dr. Larijani, who in the past was the head of the Supreme National Security Council, and he was also the Speaker of Parliament for three terms. He is going to. I think it will be announced in a few days or shortly that he is going to be the head of the Supreme National Security Council. And this council for defense is going to be a body under the authority of the Supreme National Security Council.
We know that before, I want to talk about Gaza and the situation in Gaza, but before going there, we know that they're trying to do everything in Lebanon to disarm Hezbollah. It's the pressure is unbelievable in Lebanon. And we've seen people are coming out, supporters of Hezbollah, and people of Lebanon are coming out against these sort of policies on the part of the government, the foreign pressure coming from the United States, basically. And how do you see the situation with a case of disarmament of Hezbollah?
Well, you know, it's very sad that that Erdogan, and sometimes some of my Turkish friends tell me that you're very harsh towards Erdogan. But it's difficult not to be harsh to someone who refuses. It's impossible not to be harsh for me to be not to be harsh to someone who refuses to cut off ties with the Israeli regime after 2 years of Holocaust. Erdogan has collaborated with NATO, the United States, in destroying Syria. He's more responsible than anyone else for the hundreds of thousands of deaths and bringing ISIS and al-Qaeda to power. And we know that these were tools of the United States. We know that the Israeli regime was cooperating with these groups. There's no hiding these facts anymore. Those who supported this so-called revolution, they were delusional. They were fooling themselves. And all the things that we were predicting back then, all of that has happened. All the predictions were correct. You have these extremists that are tearing the country apart, exactly as the Israeli regime wants. They are carrying out genocidal policies against everyone across the country, and they're pushing the country towards disintegration and they're balkanizing the country. That's basically it. And that was the objective all along. And those who were foolish enough to support these policies, they are now seeing, and if they are still closing their eyes, they're going to see this continue. Hopefully the tide will turn. Well, when it comes to these countries, Qatar and Turkey and others who are funding these ISIS and Al-Qaeda groups, among others, they're not doing anything for Gaza. They're not providing them with any military support. They're carrying out business as usual with the Israeli regime, with the United States, and with the West. In Lebanon, it's the Saudis. The Saudis are collaborating with the Americans and, of course, the Israelis to try to undermine Hezbollah and the resistance. And we know that if there's no resistance in Lebanon, the state is not going to protect the people. We know that. So what they are doing is they're, out of spite and hatred for the resistance, they are making Lebanon vulnerable, but they're buying off politicians. Many of these politicians already bought off. These pro-Western politicians and the fascists, like the Lebanese forces, they're all working together to undermine the resistance. So sadly, not only are important countries in the region, their leaders, not helping the resistance and the Palestinian people, they've been working to undermine them. When the Americans were bombing Yemen, Yemen was imposing the genocide convention. When the Americans were bombing Yemen, the Qataris, their bases and their facilities and their airspace and their land was being used by the Americans. So yes, right now the situation in Lebanon is very difficult, but Hezbollah is not going to disarm. And what the president of Lebanon is going to do under duress or wants to do is only going to lead the country towards greater danger. And we have to keep in mind that Lebanon, the majority of the people, according to polls, according to the recent local elections, they are with the resistance. But the Americans are trying to impose, and the Saudis, they're impose their will, and the Israelis impose their will on the Lebanese people. Hopefully, this will there will be a solution, and they will come to their senses because the resistance cannot afford to give up their arms. But this is the sad state of affairs, that the axis of resistance is not only confronting the Israeli regime, it's not only confronting the collective West, but its work is being disrupted, and its effectiveness is being weakened by regional partners of the West.
I don't know if you watched the interviews of the U.S. Green Beret Colonel Aguilar, and he was picturing the situation in Gaza. He did various interviews in which he was trying to show us, all of us, what's going on in Gaza. He said that they have reduced the centers, the 8 centers, from 400 to 4. And these 4 centers are in the middle of war zone. And they're bringing people in the war zone. They're killing people coming in and getting out of this zone. And in your opinion, when we learn about the reality of what's going on in Gaza, it's not about Hezbollah. It's not about Iran. It's just someone that was somehow cooperating with GHF and this organization that is collaborating with Israelis, IDF, and he said that these organizations are simply bringing these people to kill them, mostly killing them, but not feeding them. And what's your take on that? And how is that going to change the atmosphere? How is that going to change the public opinion somehow? I don't know if can we be optimistic about the outcome of the reality of Gaza and these people who are talking about the situation there?
As we discussed earlier, the situation is changing very rapidly, and things have been going downhill for the Israeli regime and its allies and its apologists for a long time now. But ever since we've been seeing images of starving children and starving adults coming out of Gaza, despite the silence of Western media, and despite the fact that Western media has been lying and saying that these are manipulated and they've been trying to, they're basically Holocaust deniers. But the only difference is that they're denying the Holocaust as the Holocaust is happening. They are as sinister and as evil, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or the BBC or any other outlet or the CNN, when they promote these narratives, they are just as evil as Netanyahu himself. But the narrative is changing very rapidly, and people are speaking up, and people's eyes are being opened. And we see public opinion has shifted tremendously against the Israeli regime in the West. And I believe that probably the polls are somewhat manipulated in the West too. I think it's probably even worse than what the polls in the West and in the United States in particular are saying. So it's, you know, and the more the West tries to hide this, the more they become discredited. And it's clear that it's taking a toll in the West. The fact that Western governments are talking about recognizing Palestine, even though it's all cynical and it's just deception. It's basically trying to silence people, protesters at home, and to make it seem as if they're taking action, which they're not. There are no sanctions imposed on the Israeli regime. They're providing them with aid, with weapons, with political cover. Just a couple of weeks ago, they sanctioned Iran again for, I don't know, human rights or something, a number of people. They don't do that to Israel as the Holocaust is being carried out. So they are buying time, but the very fact that they do have to take these measures, they have to say that we may recognize Palestine. They didn't say they will, but they say we may recognize Palestine on a piece of paper, which is not going to change anything on the ground. But that is a sign that things are not going well. That is a sign that things are going very badly. And people are increasingly using the term, not just genocide, but Holocaust. And that, I think, is big. That has delegitimized the regime and its apologists. And remember, 10 years from now, people are going to go back and see who said what about what is going on in Palestine and when. The children of these television presenters and these pundits and the grandchildren are going to remember them as those who helped enable a Holocaust. Once I said this to just recently, I think I've caught a cold. Just recently, I said this to what's his name? The gentleman who I've been on his show a few times in the UK.
Piers Morgan.
I said you're a genocide enabler, which he has been over the last. He continued to promote lies about October the 7th. Just yesterday, or hours ago, when they asked Trump about genocide in Gaza, he went and spoke about October the 7th. According to some estimates, well over 400,000 people have died. Remember the deaths that have been announced by the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Those are just the bodies that have been buried. The thousands and many thousands of bodies that are missing or buried, and the many thousands of people are dying of starvation or malnutrition or illness that was preventable. And the the countless number of people who were injured and later died. So many people have died indirectly as a result of this war. And then the hundreds of thousands who were maimed, who've lost their limbs or their eyes or their faces have been blown apart. This is a Holocaust. And those who were trying to, you know, push this October the 7th narrative, they're all a part of this Holocaust. They are all enablers. And even the whole October the 7th hoax, you know, about beheaded babies and the alleged rapes, all of that nonsense, you know, they've never provided evidence for this, but they did that to help the Israeli regime carry out the genocide in the Holocaust. And they still try to do it, as we saw with Trump. So this is going to, these people are going to pay a heavy price for what they're doing. But the very fact that increasingly voices, mainstream voices, are turning against the Israeli regime and against this Holocaust and against Western elites that support it, I think this is a very important sign. And it only means that the supporters of the Palestinians have to push much harder. It's not the time to be complacent. Everyone has to double their efforts for the Palestinian people. They have to put pressure on their governments to cut off ties with the regime. They have to put pressure, whether in our neighborhood, in our region, or elsewhere, or abroad. And they have to continue working hard to wake up those increasingly, the smaller number of people now who are still asleep. They have to do what they can to wake them up too.
Thank you so much, Professor Marandi. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Sorry, I think I've caught a cold, so I hope I was coherent.
You were.